Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NWA Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NWA Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a guest that many of you, well, you may know Aaron because I'm talking about Aaron Holland, of course, and Aaron writes at Global Security Review. He's written a number of great articles, but he's a young guy, and he's the reason we have Aaron on NucleCast is because for many of our listeners, workforce issues, recruitment, retention are big issues. And Aaron is he's a young guy. He's got his master's degree. He's working on his doctorate. And during his time as a master's student, he got really interested in nuclear issues. And he got so interested in it that, he ended up coming to join the National Institutes of Deterrence Studies as an analyst. And then he's written tons of articles. He's done tons of research. He's working on his, he said, I want to go get a doctorate in this kind of stuff. And then ultimately he said, I want to go work in the field. And so he's about to join the government and go work at Stratcom. And so he wants to make a career and a life of this. And so what we thought we would do is talk to Aaron about, sort of what drives that passion. How did you get it? Where did it come from? So that you, the listeners, can say, this might be insightful for me as I go out and try to recruit and retain talent. So with that in mind, Aaron, welcome to NucleCast.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So have you always, loved all things nuclear since you were a young babe in your mother's womb? And, you as soon as you popped out, you were like, Mom, I want to be a nuclear guy. Or did it not work that way? That's how it worked for me. But how did it work for you?
No, I have not always been a nuclear guy. In fact, in my master's program pretty early on, I always considered myself a grand strategist. I worked with Dr. Annette Popescu, who's a pretty well-renowned offensive realist, an officer in the U.S. Navy as well. And he worked in the Grand Strategy Division. And a lot of his work is on American grand strategy. And initially I was very interested in grand strategy, but I always got hicked up on the deterrence aspect of things. What is the role of nuclear weapons? And for me, I am very fascinated with puzzles, questions that are, complex. And I always found deterrence to be the most complex question within the grand strategy of, equation itself. And so for me, it was curiosity. Being very curious, when I was trying to create a grand strategic, outline for my master's thesis, I couldn't quite figure out what was the role of nuclear weapons, what was the role of deterrence, and it led me down to a giant rabbit hole, effectively, in the deterrence literature. And then I just became a lot more educated, and I kind of shifted gears, started working with Dr. Tom Doyle at Texas State, who is a nuclear weapons ethics expert, and he works on a little bit different questions, but effectively, he was an incredible mentor for me and just guided me throughout the literature. And I asked a bunch of questions of why do nuclear weapons not get used? And so that's kind of where my research angle originated from, was kind of figuring out why are they not used in particular historical cases where I thought it was maybe rational to have used them, like the Korean War, for example, where Douglas MacArthur on a number of occasions requested the use of nuclear weapons. And that time it'd be more atomic weapons, but requested their use on a number of strategic sites. And Truman eventually removed him from power from a lot of these different disputes that they had. But just diving into the archives and listening to the Joint Chiefs of Staff arguments, listening to their debates, what was the role of nuclear weapons in these particular cases. And that's really where I really got fascinated with the, what is the role of nuclear weapons within our grand strategic framework? And then that's how I got into the nuclear field. I just became more or less awestruck by the puzzles because they're very complex. There's a lot of factors and variables that you have to account for to make deterrence effective and to understand why they don't get used. And so that's what led me down that little rabbit hole.
Now, did you come from sort of a military background? Did you come from, a background where you had family members or friends or uncles, aunts, any of that, that sort of worked in this area so that you had, or was this just sort of straight out of the blue? You just so happened to go to college. You just so happened to ask this question and it just so happened to lead you down this rabbit hole and bam, there you were. This is so cool.
More of the latter. So I mean, my grandfather was in the United States military. He served in the Army, was in Vietnam, and then his father before him and his father before him. And we had a long generation of U.S. military personnel being within my family. But since my grandfather, none of us have been in the military. Like, my father's not really in my life, but on my mother's side, none of them were in the military. None of my, I do have an uncle that joined the Army for about 4 years, enlisted, but for the most part, no, I don't have any type of military background. And I just happened to stumble upon the right professors, the right mentors that were able to guide me and, kind of just emerged in this rabbit hole that is the nuclear deterrence field itself. And I was just fascinated by the different complex questions and understanding the different variables that lead to its effectiveness or its failures. And that's just kind of how it came about.
So you wrote your master's thesis and then, you know, you finish. And you're like, man, what do I do with the rest of my life at this point? And so you're now, you know, graduating. And then what do you do?
Well, that's a great question. And we're actually going to get into a little bit of, recruitment issues. So I actually tried to join the United States military as an officer. I wanted to commission as an officer into the Army. The reality is I had a bit of a troubled teens. I had a lot of trauma that endured, and I ended up getting 3 misdemeanors on my record. And for whatever reason, the United States military wouldn't give me a waiver for one of these misdemeanors. And so I think this goes into issues about recruitment and its failure to recognize good talent and obtain good talent and rejecting good talent because of whatever bureaucratic issues there are within the recruitment side of things. But I'd gone through MEPS, I went through all that stuff, and eventually they just were refusing to give me a waiver. And so after I was not able to commission as an officer, which was ultimately my goal. I wanted to become an officer in the United States military and work my way up the chain of command and eventually apply my research into actual practice that way. But it didn't work out. And so I eventually shifted gears and I thought, well, you know what? I got this good master's thesis that I wrote, and we wrote it with the idea of it eventually becoming a doctoral dissertation. And so I decided to shift gears and pursue my PhD. And I got lucky enough to have a few offers. And throughout the offers, I chose to go to the University of Utah to work with particular mentors here. And that's kind of how I got to where I'm at. But I think a lot of it's due to recruitment issues within the military and a failure to be able to recognize and obtain good talent. And maybe that's a bias because I think I'm good talent, but maybe the recruiters didn't think I was good talent. But I do think that that's one of the issues that kind of led me down this path and why I got here. And I'm very thankful I got my foot in the door with NIDS as well and the National Institute for Deterrent Studies and the ability to be an analyst, and gave me a platform to write the different research articles on with the Global Security Review. And very thankful for all those opportunities that people do give me when they do recognize that I have some form of talent that is capable of being contributing to whatever the game plan is or whatever the success story is for the particular outlet or the institution. But yeah, that's kind of how I ended up where I'm at currently.
So for folks who want to go out and, let's say, get a PhD, there's the opportunities, the number of folks, at least from, you know, my assessment, the number of places that you as a aspiring PhD student who wants to, you know, look at deterrence and look at, you know, the use and deployment of nuclear weapons, it seems pretty small. There's not a lot of folks that look at it. And the majority tend to look at, you know, arms control and disarmament and non-proliferation instead of, you know, how do I make deterrence work effectively? Was that your assessment? Was that what you found? How did you sort of process through that and ultimately find the right person to work with?
I would actually fully agree with you. Most people at my age that are in this field, they're certainly on the disarmament side of things. They tend to view things about how can we negotiate more arms control agreements to limit the amount of strategic nuclear weapons we have or tactical nuclear warheads that we have. And a lot of them are ultimate goal is to get to nuclear zero and, you know, have zero nuclear warheads. But I don't view that. I mean, I worked with a constructivist that believed in the transcendence of the security dilemma in particular, and thought that there are certain ways that you can go about to achieve disarmament. But, you know, that's the thing. You can work with mentors that are great mentors, that are incredible people with you, but you may disagree on certain topics like that. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion through my own research that that was not an achievable goal, and that that deterrence leads to peace, and that the failures of deterrence is what leads to war. And so a lot of my research now focuses on how to make deterrence more effective, how to accomplish more of these strategic goals that we have in mind, rather than looking at arms control or disarmament goals. And yeah, the mentors that I found at Utah, you know, they all have different
opinions.
How
did you go about finding them? Like there's a lot of, you know, universities that offer PhD programs, and, you know, you're in international relations. There's probably several hundred universities across the country that offer that PhD program. How would you know where to go, or who were the 5, 10, 15, 20 guys and gals that this is what they specialize in? What's that process look like? And so think for the listeners, how can listeners do a better job of helping young folks sort of get on a path, and a path that ultimately leads to, you know, useful employment where they do meaningful work?
Yeah, in my opinion, it's all networking. It's all people that help you get your foot in the door in different places. Because if you're trying to do it all by yourself, it's very difficult to connect with these different scholars. I mean, people are working on book manuscripts, they're working on journal articles, they're working on X, Y, and Z. And so for you to get your foot in the door and connect with these different people really requires a lot of effort for a mentor on your part to really guide you and help you out and to connect with these other individuals on your behalf and to bat on your behalf. I mean, that's how I got into Utah. I mean, I had professors that were willing to bat on my behalf, that were able to speak about my abilities, that were able to say, hey, Aaron's a really good scholar. He's really interested in these topics. He's extremely passionate. He's super curious. He's open-minded about a lot of different things. And we think he'd be great for you to work with. And that's how I got my foot in the door with like Dr. Stephen LaBelle here at University of Utah, or Dr. Brent Steele here. It was just through other people that opened those doors for me. Because, I mean, you can do all you want on your end as a young scholar to try to get into these places. You can try to do all the publications you want. You always hear about publish or perish in this field. And I think a lot of that's true. But also it's, you know, how you get into certain places, I think, is networking. And it's people that are able to bat on your behalf and open different doors for you. If they believe you're worthy of these things, they believe you're talented enough. I mean, a lot of that becomes on their perspectives on you as well. I mean, there's a number of professors that didn't think I was worthy to be at their program or didn't think I was skilled enough or whatnot. But I had a number of people that did and showed me a lot of love in that way. And I'm very appreciative for all those different things. But what I would tell to those listeners that are hearing us and trying to figure out how do we help these young talent get into the nuclear field, I mean, it's got a lot of it's on y'all. I mean, it's on you're in to help out these young scholars that you believe are worthy to be in this field. I mean, you hear about gatekeeping a lot, and I think there's certainly some of that, but I haven't experienced a whole lot of gatekeeping. For the amount of people that have opened doors for me is incredible. And I'm always appreciative of those things. And I always try to pay it forward too in the future. Like that's one of my biggest goals, is to be able to pay it forward to young talent that maybe comes from struggle situations like myself, that doesn't have, you know, certain external support. But regardless, that's the best thing I could say, is that there's just a number of amazing people that have been in this field, that have been through it. They got their PhDs. They went into the nuclear side of things, and they achieved a lot of great things, like yourself and like Curtis McGiffin, et cetera. And these people opened doors for me. And a lot of it's on me, too, and on the young scholar as well, to once you get your foot in the door, to prove you're worthy of being there. And I think every time I get my foot in the door, I'm able of doing that. But a lot of it's the networking side of things, and it's the ability for senior scholars, senior professionals to open those doors for the younger talent.
Yeah, for me, it's also interesting because, you know, the way I ended up picking where I, you know, went to go get a PhD was I had a book one day, and I, you know, I was a graduate student at Arizona State, and I went to my advisor and I said, hey, I'm reading this book by this guy, Don Snow. It's a pretty good book. I kind of like it. And my advisor says, well, you've got a bachelor's and master's degree here at Arizona State. You got to go somewhere else. You can't get all three from here. So why don't you, Don Snow's at Alabama. I know him. You should go study with him. And that was that. I applied to one program, went and studied with Don Snow and got a PhD. And then it just so happened that I knew folks in my graduate program that were Air Force. And then they said, hey, we're standing up this thing called the Air Force Research Institute. Why don't you come join us? And I said, yes. So you, in many respects, it's a lot about saying yes to opportunities. But it's also about trying to create opportunities. And for some, for a lot of folks, they, you know, young folks, they don't know how to create opportunities. So if you were to give young folks some advice who might be listening, who are just like, man, I'm interested, because there's a lot of, we had Brian Bender on, who wrote a great article a while back about the lack of talent in the nuclear enterprise. And a lot of folks that he interviewed said, well, it's really, really hard to get into the nuclear enterprise. And, you know, because they didn't want to pursue the military, which is sort of one of your major entry points. They didn't want to pursue the intelligence community, and they didn't necessarily want to pursue, you know, the civil service route supporting, you know, the military and the government. And so it's like, well, you're sort of cutting yourself off of the sort of the major entry points into the enterprise. So it's probably going to be kind of hard to get in. But for folks who, you know, you sort of shared your pursuit of, you know, commissioning, but when you're not going that route, how can young people sort of try to make efforts that help them get their foot in the door? You know, is it going to conferences? Is it, you know, finding a book that you really like and calling somebody or emailing them? You know, what were the approaches that you took to try to create opportunities?
Yeah, I think what you're touching on is the networking side of things. And networking is extremely important. You got to be able to reach out to these professors, shoot them emails, call them up if you can, let them know, I've read your work, I think it's impressive, I'd love to do research with you. I mean, the other thing is, you got to be resilient in this field. You got to be able to accept rejection. I've been rejected so many times. I've sent more emails than you could imagine and just had no responses, or got emails back saying, I'm too busy, I don't have the capabilities to work with you on a dissertation. I mean, there's a lot of that. And so you got to be resilient. You got to be able to accept rejection in a lot of different ways. And you got to be able to just take it on the chin and keep moving and try to improve your own work. And but I think a lot of it's just networking. Yeah, you got to read a good book. You got to think, wow, this scholar really has intrigued me. He posed a lot of questions for me that I think are interesting. I want to pursue answering these different puzzles that he's posed in this book. And you got to be able to reach out to them. You got to email them. You got to connect with them. And you got to say, hey, I'd like to do work with you. I'd like to do research with you. I think you're a great scholar. Do you have any interest in doing, you know, potential research with me? Here's my background. Here's my side of my research questions that I'm looking at. And again, like I said, you got to be able to be resilient and accept rejection in a lot of ways too, because you're going to have a lot of dead ends. But when you get those foot in the doors, you got to run with it. Like you said, when you get an opportunity, you got to take it for everything you got. And I'm appreciative of every opportunity I've been given. And I run with it every time I get an opportunity, because from someone that comes from a low socioeconomic status without a father in my life, every opportunity I get, I take and I run with it.
Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, you know, you're kind of unique. We've talked a lot about, you know, sort of the academic side of, you know, the nuclear enterprise in terms of, you know, writing books and getting a PhD. But for you, you don't actually want to pursue an academic career. You want to pursue a career of practice. And so when we get back, I want you to sort of tell us, how do you go about doing that? Because, you know, a lot of the practitioners don't write books, and they're not sort of out in public. They're, you know, in places where their names are not public. So I want you to tell me sort of, how do you get involved with those folks? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Aaron Holland. And as I said in the beginning of the show, Aaron's a PhD student. He's somebody I've worked with, you know, and for those of you working on talent management and trying to figure it out and recruit and retain folks, Aaron is kind of one of those guys, right? And so he's had that experience. And, you know, the point here is to share it with our listeners so that they can perhaps get some lessons learned. So I posed a question to you, Aaron. What say you? How did you do that?
Yeah. So how I got interested in pursuing the workforce side of things. Like I had mentioned earlier, I wanted to commission as an officer and it didn't work through. So a lot of it was just sitting around thinking, how can I make this career work? Like if it didn't work in the military side of things, what are the civilian side of things that I could pursue? And a lot of it was just sitting, thinking, plotting, scheming, you know, whatever adjective you want to use or verb. I mean, I was sitting there and just pondering often, how can I pursue a career in this? Because, I mean, as you've been in the academic field before, you understand that the academic positions are highly competitive and there's about 200 applicants per job posting. I mean, it's stiff competition. I understand these things. And I'm not even sold on the idea of like having an academic career, like you mentioned. So for me, it was just thinking, how can I pursue a job in the nuclear field on the civilian side of things that can also achieve my long-term goals? And that's where I started thinking, well, let me look at who's at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Who are our members? What jobs do they have? And looking through, it takes a lot of effort on my part to do the research and see like what kind of opportunities are available out there. What kind of jobs, you know, can I pursue that, you know, can it let me achieve my long-term goals in this workforce? And eventually it led me down to finding out who Dr. Jennifer Bradley was. She's a member of our think tank at NIDS, and she works at United States Strategic Command on the civilian side of the Air Force. And I thought, wow, that's a very interesting, you know, work that you have doing. And then eventually, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn and I look at job postings all the time on LinkedIn. I look at different opportunities in our field. I type in nuclear weapons job postings and I just sit there and dig through them. What looks best for my situation? How can I put something that looks really good on my resume to pursue my career that helped me fund my PhD and things like that? And eventually she posted a position that just seemed ideal for me. I mean, it was a psychological researcher role at United States Strategic Command. I happen to have a psychology bachelor's degree on top of my political science degrees as well. And I thought, well, I don't know many people that are going to be well suited for this position. I did the math and I thought, well, maybe there's like 10 people in our field that would be possibly suited for this job. And considering it was at the GS-9, GS-11 pay scale, I figured, well, if you already have a PhD, they're probably pursuing the GS-13 pay scale jobs. And so I was like, you know, there's probably not a whole lot of people working on a PhD that are pursuing this particular role. And I crunched the numbers on my own end doing a rational cost benefit calculus. And I figured I'm probably the best person for this job. I'm going to put in an application for it. And if I get rejected, I get rejected. I get rejected all the time. So I'm very comfortable with accepting rejection, but it ended up working out great. Went through the hiring process. And next thing you know, that's the next opportunity that looks like it's down the horizon for me now. And I'm very thankful for those opportunities. And, but like I said, a lot of it's on our part too, as the young scholars, the young people interested in this work field. I mean, you got to sit around and think, how am I going to make it work in this field, whether it's the military side of things or whether it's the civilian side of things. And you got to sit there and you got to go through LinkedIn, you got to go through usajobs.com, and you got to just like go through the different opportunities that were in the nuclear field. And there's not a ton. So you got to figure out what's best for my situation and what I've worked on research-wise or what I've done in the workforce as well, because there's a lot of ex-military that can go into academia and then want to pursue a job in the, you know, United States strategic civilian side things of too. So a lot of it's on our end to sit there and figure out what is it I want to do. But that's how I came about in the pursuing this particular role at United States Strategic Command. And like I said, a lot of it was just sitting there pondering, figuring out how can I make this work?
Yeah. You've kind of said one of the most important things, and that's perseverance. Because you're going to get rejected a lot. I mean, I remember getting rejected. I would apply for like 100 jobs and I might get interviewed for 5. And so I just sort of figured it's probably a 10-1, 15-1 ratio. And it just is what it is. And especially when you're young and inexperienced and you're trying to really establish yourself, it's a lot of perseverance. If you were to start, you know, I guess we'll go ahead and, you know, we'll go ahead and jump to bringing out Bob the Genie. You know, we'll spend some time with Bob and I rub my magic lamp and Bob's of course going to grant you 3 wishes. And so I'd be curious if we're thinking, you know, Bob's granting you sort of workforce development wishes and you were to think, you know, sort of wishes that would both help you, but also help the workforce find the talent that it needs. What would be your first wish?
That's a really good question. I think, the biggest thing is finding good mentors and having mentors that are willing to work with you, I think is so critical in this field and being able to to bat on your behalf. I mean, because if you're coming from academia and you don't have any military background, like we've mentioned, it's hard to get into the nuclear field. You got to have a lot of perseverance. But having those people that are willing to bat on your behalf, I mean, just to be candid, when we were going through the interview process, Dr. Bradley called you up and she asked you about my expertise and how you thought I would be a good role for the job. And you batted on my behalf. And that's just being very candid and honest about that whole process. And I think that's so critical. It's having those people that they're not gatekeepers, you know, like I said, I haven't run into gatekeepers, but you hear it all the time. And so the fact that there's people like you that are out there that are willing to, even if we have different ideas on certain topics, and I'm sure we do, and have different, and, you know, views about certain things, you know, politics wise too, I'm sure that happens all the time. But the fact that, you know, we can put all that aside and we're able to work out these different things, and you're willing to bat on my behalf on these type of situations, I mean, that means the world to me, and it'll mean the world to anybody that's also trying to pursue a job in this field. And so anybody that's out there that has a young talent that they know that is capable of pursuing a job in this workforce, I mean, a lot of it's on y'all's end to be willing to do these different things and take time out of your day to bat on our behalf. But that's how we progress in this field, I think, in so many ways. It's through the networking side of things. It's through the perseverance on our end. But it's also on the incredible opportunities. When you see it, you got to run with it. And that's the biggest thing, is just, like, I want to pay it forward. And so if Bob the Genie asked me, you know, what would you be able to do for the workforce in the future? It's just pay it forward. Any way I can. When I find good talent, I'll do everything I can to pay it forward for them. And just like people have done everything they can to pay it forward for me, when they have no blood in the game, they have no stake in it, no financial incentive to help me out, but they're willing to do it. They're willing to take the time out of their day and help me out. I mean, though, you got to recognize those type of people. You got to surround yourself with that wise counsel, and you got to run with the opportunities when you're given them. And that's what I would say. Bob the Genie, you know, do everything you can to let the nuclear experts out there that are looking for young talent, when they recognize that young talent, bat on their behalf. You know, do everything you can to help them out, and they'll learn the lessons that they can learn in that process, and hopefully they'll look to pay it forward as well. You know, when you guys are long gone and retired, and I'm in my 50s and whatnot, looking at the next group of talent, I hope I can do everything I can that you've done for me in my life and help me, you know, out in all these different situations. And that's what I would say to Bob the Genie.
So if you were to sort of design a program that Bob's, of course, going to make happen, and it was a program that would sort of go out and find or somehow, because like whenever I was a young guy, there was a lot of opportunities I didn't know about. There were whole career fields I didn't even know existed. And I kind of have looked back now that I'm an old guy and think like, man, had I known about all these other things, How would I have made different choices? How would I have sort of more efficiently pursued, you know, a career that I wanted? So as you think about that, are there certain things now that, you know, sort of being early in that stage, you wish would have existed? Do you wish, you know, guys and gals who are, you know, at weapons labs or in, you know, uniformed officers or whatever would have come and spoken in, you know, classes to undergraduates, or, you know, is there anything that you've ever thought, man, I wish somebody would have done this?
I think you're speaking music to my ears right now. That is exactly what I wish happened. I mean, I wish that there were military officers that would take the time out of their day, come, and there are, I mean, you see it all the time. At times they'll do symposiums and conferences, but to reach out, I mean, in our field, in political science, I mean, a lot of us are trying to, and especially in international relations, I mean, there's not a whole lot of people that walk into classrooms and say, hey, there's these opportunities in this workforce. There's opportunities in this field. If you're interested in pursuing something within the deterrence field, like these are what's available to you. Come check these out. Like, I wish there was more of that. And oftentimes there's symposiums, but they're hard to get to. They can be at, you know, different states, different cities, time zones, et cetera. And it's, you know, financially on my end of things, like, finances are tight in a PhD program. And so to like fly out to, you know, the United States Strategic Command symposium that they host and stuff like that, it's very difficult to do those type of things, even though I wish I had the more opportunities to do those type of things. And so I don't know the best response to that. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I think increasing the amount of presence you have in the universities would help. Maybe even, I can't speak to the military side of things. I've never been in the military. You'd be more capable of that than I, but I think the recruitment side of things has to improve to some degree. You got to be able to go into classrooms and talk to these different professors and say, do you have any talent that you're working with that is maybe interested in these type of positions, that are interested in these type of roles that we have available to you? Kind of scheming on y'all's part too. And I know NIDS has done a great thing on its behalf to try to get more involved into the classrooms and showing that there's different opportunities available. But there's a lot of universities, there's a lot of talent out there, but how do you sift through it? It's challenging. And there's maybe 200 people that focus on the nuclear weapons deterrent side of things at my age, maybe even less than that. So, I mean, to recruit that particular talent is even more challenging, I think, in some ways, because then you got to it's a lot of effort to go through and figure out where are these people at and how can I recruit them. But, you know, they're out there and they're definitely looking for opportunities. And a lot of it is financial constraints. You know, I think that's certainly one side of it for young people like myself. Like, we don't have necessarily certain opportunities to go out and fly to the Stratcom symposium and come meet all these different professionals. But when they are available, I think you got to run with those opportunities, because that's when you're going to network and you're going to do the most face-to-face talking. And face-to-face is where so much takes place at. So you can do a lot through email, but, you know, and you can do Zoom meetings and you can do Microsoft Teams meetings and meet with these different people that way. But, you know, like you said, I think the conferences are huge. Maybe increase the number of conferences that people do. I don't know. I mean, a lot of that's all financials though too. So, and I can't really speak to the economic side on a lot of different think tanks or different institutions side of things, but I think that 100% that if you increase the presence within classrooms and increase the presence within probably the military personnel and trying to find what talent is interested in these type of things, that would certainly help us with more knowledge about what is available in the workforce and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an area where, you know, the ANWA Deterrence Center, which sponsors this podcast, it's one of the big areas where ANWA is really making an effort to try to, you know, reach out and promote brown bag sessions and do all kinds of efforts so that, you know, ANWA recognizes the importance of reaching out to folks who may not have, you know, expected to spend a career at the National Nuclear Security Administration or, you know, within, you know, the contractors, the various contractors that support, you know, Air Force A-10 or whatever, because people don't know about that. And so I think that's, you know, there are organizations like ANWA that are, you know, actively trying to make that happen or, you know, help sell the role of the nuclear enterprise so that, you know, young engineers, for example, might say, you know what, I want to go build the Sentinel or I want to go build the B-21. And because that's part of it is you got to have organizations like ANWA or NIDS or whomever that help, you know, go out and talk to people and say, hey, listen, there's all these career opportunities that can really, you know, be lead you down a path where you do a lot of really interesting and incredible work. So now we're at the end of the show, but if you were sort of making your final elevator speech to the listeners who are, you know, a lot of the gray beards and, you know, in the nuclear enterprise and you wanted to give them some sage advice from a young guy, what would that be?
Wow. That's a good question. I mean, I would say that, and we've kind of touched on these different things, but do whatever you can to pay it forward to the young talent that's out there that's looking to get into this industry. And if they show you a genuine interest on their part, a genuine passion, and that's the thing, like if you can recognize they have a passion for this field, you just pay it forward however you can, because that means the world to us young scholars, and we'll do everything we can to pay it forward when we're in your position as well. When we're the old graybeards, you know, that's all I can say is that, you know, I can't give you any financial incentive to help me out. I can't give you any research incentive for the most part to help me out, but if you do help me out and you help out any other young scholar that's out there, we'll do everything we can to pay it forward because we're passionate about this field. I love deterrence. I love peace. Deterrence equals peace, and I'll do anything I can to make sure that the nuclear enterprise maintains that position, deterrence through peace, and trying to make it more effective as best as possible. If it's even possible. A lot of people question if it is, but I truly believe it is. And so that would be my answer to these old gray beards. If you could pay it forward to the young people, they'll pay it forward when they're in your position as well.
All right. Well, thanks, Aaron, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. You know, Aaron's such a you know, such a nice young guy. You hate calling him kids because he's, you know, he's mid-20s, but a young guy and he's early in his career. And I, of course, looking forward to all the great things he's going to do. But it was, hopefully you found it interesting to hear sort of, you know, his take from just sort of an average Joe on how they found themselves, you know, on this path to this kind of a career. And so hopefully for you, the listeners, that was useful.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.